In the coming week, Americans enter the final two-month stretch of the presidential campaign. The United States moves to expand economic ties with Taiwan, and Japan begins its search for a new prime minister. It's September 3rd, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, I'm speaking on September 3rd, which puts us at exactly 2 months before the U.S. presidential election on November 3rd. Across the country, we're already seeing ramped up preparations by states for things like mail-in ballots amidst a great deal of angst and controversy. Back in Washington, Congress is set to return to session. So we saw both candidates, President Trump and former Vice President Biden, get some boosts after their respective conventions. Can you tell us a little bit more about how Americans are preparing for this election, Jim?
Well, I suspect, Bob, that many Americans just want it to be over already. We have been in a perpetual campaign. Give you some perspective. John F. Kennedy, back in 1960, threw his hat in the ring in January of 1960, 10 months before Election Day. Whereas during this electoral cycle, the first Democrat formally declared more than 3 years ago. You know, now that we're exactly 2 months out, most polls show Biden leading President Trump nationally. If you go to Real Clear Politics, which does an average of the polls, 538 does something similar, it shows former Vice President Biden with the 7 percentage point lead in the national surveys. Now, historically, the candidate leading the polls on Labor Day almost always wins the popular vote. But as everybody knows, winning the popular vote doesn't mean winning the presidency. You need to win the Electoral College. So I think for people trying to sort of figure out what's happening, I would urge them to spend less time looking at the national polls and a lot more time trying to figure out what's happening in the 7 or so battleground states. And here I'm talking about states like Arizona, Florida, Iowa, Michigan, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And I would actually recommend an interactive that the New York Times put up, which is about the road that President Trump and former Vice President Biden would have to getting to the 270 mark you need to win the Electoral College. It's really, really good. Now, of course, last time, 2016, many of the state public opinion polls, unlike the national polls, actually weren't very good. Now, pollsters have spent a lot of time trying to learn from the mistakes of what they made back in 2016, and they're certainly doing a lot more polling. So I think we have a bit better of a sense of what the mood is in the battleground states. But sort of going forward, you know, the obvious wild card is what's going to happen with mail-in ballots. You mentioned that in your question. And there's also been a lot of talk in recent days about a so-called red mirage. That's the idea that President Trump will be leading on election night with millions of mail-in ballots yet to be counted. And those ballots could take days to count. And if it's the case that substantially more Democrats vote by mail than Republicans do, and that's what a number of polls show will be the case, then President Trump's lead could vanish in the days to come, leading to claims that, in fact, what President Trump had argued all along, that mail-in ballots would lead to the election being stolen from him. So you got that sort of perspective problem to worry about. What I think has been lost in a lot of talk about mail-in balloting is that the events we normally associate with moving voters in the closing weeks of an election campaign may not have the same kind of impact this year around. Now, normally we talk about the debates as being a big factor. People get to see the two candidates. One candidate makes a mistake. Another candidate has a really good line, and that may move some voters. But with mail-in balloting, you're likely to have large numbers of people voting before all of the debates have been conducted. I'll note that North Carolina is going to begin sending out absentee ballots starting tomorrow morning. One last wild card to point out is the role of social media. It's been well reported that the Russians have been continuing their efforts to interfere in elections, much as they did back in 2016. These efforts have largely involved trying to manipulate the way social media companies operate and exploit their platforms. The various social media companies have taken some steps in that score on that Facebook recently closed down a bunch of pages that it said were somehow linked to Russian interference. I'll also note that Facebook just today announced that it's going to prohibit new political advertisements in the week before the U.S. presidential election. And it's likewise going to seek to flag premature claims of victory by candidates. Again, this gets back to, you know, variations of that red mirage scenario I talked about a few moments ago. But all in all, I think even for people who spend a lot of time thinking about elections, there's a lot of uncertainty over how things are going to unfold over the next 2 months. So my only advice is to buckle up.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot to process there, but obviously this context of voting under a pandemic, it seems to indicate that the Democrats are less inclined, at least this is the assumption, less inclined to show up in person at voting places where there could be contagion or a fear of contagion, as opposed to Republicans who are expected to turn out more in person. What I've seen though, Jim, is it's a little bit more muddled than that. There are plenty of Republicans who like to vote by mail and have done so. And there are a number of Democrats who are vowing to turn up at polling places, and that there are new places being established, you know, sports stadiums and things like that, that might be helping to facilitate or at least ease concerns about, you know, spreading and crowded polling places. On top of it all, there's been a vaccine alert put out, shall we say, about the potential for a vaccine to be authorized by November 1st, if possible. Any of this going to have a factor in what's going on, or is it all going to be a lot of the what's more to come in the next 2 months?
Well, Bob, I would put that in the big category of the unknowns, and people are going to argue back and forth about it. I mean, let's sort of take the issue of a vaccine announcement that we actually have one, and it comes, let's say, the last week in October. The real question there is going to be, what percent of the people who might have been moved will have already voted? Again, you got close to 40 states make it relatively easy to use or to vote by mail. So for a lot of people, this news may come after they've already made their decision. Likewise, again, we talk about the impact that debates can have. So I'm not really sure. There's also the question of, in terms of getting a vaccine, what percentage of the American public will, A, be eager to take the vaccine, particularly one that has been rushed into production? You sort of look out and you have, you know, obviously a small group of the public that are diehard anti-vaxxers, but you may have, you know, people who either aren't eager to take a vaccine until they have more evidence that it works, or they will interpret that news through their own political filter or screen. So you could imagine Democrats saying, you know, this is just a political move by the administration, so it's not going to change my vote at all. And Republicans saying, I knew President Trump would be able to make Operation Warp Speed work. That just leads me to double down in my commitment to him. And then that gets us back to the question of confirming opinions rather than actually changing any minds. And so I think, again, it's hard not to look at this electorate and come to the conclusion that most people know who they're going to vote for. The real big questions are, A, are they going to turn out? In B, will their votes get counted? And again, there are big questions on the latter score when it comes to mail-in ballots because of the issues of, is the ballot received on time? Again, big stories about whether or not the U.S. Postal Service will be able to deliver or not. But there's also the very real problem of people not completing ballots in the proper way so they can be counted.
Yeah, and I suspect we'll be talking a lot more about this as Election Day comes, but there is a great deal of concern and uncertainty about that period from, let's say, election night when the polls close to when all the votes are counted or many of them are counted and when the votes are certified and who has sway over that process. And seems to be a lot of jockeying going on right now in the run-up to that, including within the post office itself.
And certainly, I'll just say one last thing on this. I think it's important to stress that we do not have one national election system. We have 50 state election systems in one district election system. And in terms of counting mail-in ballots, the problem is that in about a dozen or so states that are going to be getting mail-in ballots, their rules prevent electoral officials from validating ballots or beginning the process of validating ballots and then counting them until election day itself. And so you'll have some states which will basically use the time before the election to get the process going. You're going to have some states, Michigan comes to mind, where they can't begin the process of validating ballots until election day. And again, in Michigan, they're now projecting that as many as 60% of the votes could be cast by ballot.
Really?
And so that's an awful lot of ballots to have to count if you can't start counting them or actually validating them until election. And that's a reason why people look at it and say, we may not know the results election night, because in a number of states that it will likely have high voter turnout, the actual process of saying, okay, here is a submission, is it meet all the criteria to be counted, that process doesn't begin till election day.
So hold on and hang on, everyone.
Bob, let's turn our focus to an important issue that's been getting a lot of attention in Beijing, and that's the newly expanded economic ties between the United States and Taiwan. The spokeswoman for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said this week that Chinese officials have, and let me quote her here, called on the United States to stop official interaction with Taiwan in all forms, end quote. To start, Bob, can you give us some background on this situation and then tell us a little bit how we got to where we are right now?
Sure, Jim. I'll give you some of the immediate info first, which is the predicating steps included Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen announcing just a few days ago that her administration is going to ease restrictions on imports of American pork and beef. This had been the major obstacle to what it seemed to be a potential U.S.-Taiwan bilateral free trade agreement, which could significantly expand ties between the two entities. The U.S. has been a military supporter of Taiwan for the past 40 years, even though in 79 it officially recognized one China and a one China policy and has not up to now said it's in any way that it supports Taiwan's independence. But under the Taiwan Relations Act, the U.S. is bound to help support Taiwan and its aspirations for achieving its own future with China through peaceful means. And so it's been described as a strategic ambiguity, and that has seemed to have worked over four decades. But we're in a point now where with increasing sort of assertive moves by China in its near abroad, whether you talk about border instances with India or its moves in the South China Sea or ongoing more assertive moves in the Taiwan Strait, China has signaled that Taiwan is in its sights after taking steps to also bring Hong Kong further under its fold by essentially de facto removing a number of key elements of its autonomy. So with this all going on, you've had recently a U.S. cabinet official go to Taiwan, relatively unprecedented move. The Health and Human Services Secretary was there. And then you've had this move on the economic front. This is also coupled with some outreach Taiwan has made in Eastern Europe, including with the EU member, the Czech Republic, that has infuriated China and has further sort of raised temperatures in Beijing about countries meddling in its internal affairs. It considers Taiwan integral part of China. It's a part of a sovereign China and that it is determined to bring it into the fold. Taiwan is a democracy at this point, though. It is recognized as such by only a handful of countries, and China has been moving determinedly to reduce that number. But Taiwan's having a moment right now, and it's having a moment in which it's able to first show its capabilities in terms of its response to the coronavirus. It's been extremely capable. That was sort of said to be the impetus for the HHS secretary visiting Taiwan. It has seemed to handle skillfully so far its relationship with the Trump administration, and it has cultivated what seemed to be warm ties with the Czech Republic. The response of China also earned a rare rebuke from Germany, as well as I believe from French officials, after China warned that the Czech Republic would pay a price for recent moves towards acknowledging any sort of independence of Taiwan. In this case, it was the visit to Taipei of a Czech parliamentary mission. So all sorts of things going on the Taiwan front at a time when China would rather be sort of closing in on, you know, asserting its sovereignty over Taiwan. The U.S. first and foremost, though, it seems to be intent on indicating that it can still play a role there. And it's going to be very interesting to see how the two sides sort of finesse this relationship, because I think, as our President Richard Haass has said, strategic ambiguity might have run its course and it might be more time for strategic clarity involving U.S.-Taiwan relations.
Well, Bob, can I draw you out on that point? What do we mean by strategic clarity?
Jim, I would point to a new piece in foreignaffairs.com by Richard Haass and David Sachs of CFR, where they talk about basically it's time to sort of get out in the open the U.S. support for Taiwan while also acknowledging the extent of the relationship, basically asserting that the U.S. still has a one China policy and that it will not support independence for Taiwan, but it also will come to Taiwan's defense if, in fact, it is seen as being coerced forcefully by China in any way that goes beyond, you know, sort of a peaceful resolution of their dispute. Taiwan itself has been very careful to talk about terms like independence. It's clearly exercised more of its own identity. It's been very proud of its democracy, which has only strengthened in recent decades. It has also opened itself up as a bit of a haven for people fleeing Hong Kong. That has certainly irked China quite a bit. And it's in a position, strategically important position, that, you know, should it be folded into, say, sovereign China right now, could pose a lot of further challenges, say, for U.S. assertion of influence in in the South China Sea area. So there's all sorts of elements going on here. But I think what the Peace and Foreign Affairs is arguing is that the United States should maintain the capacity to come to Taiwan's defense and make available arms for the island security, while also making clear that this is not about the U.S. sort of fighting for Taiwan's independence, per se. It seems like a narrow line to walk, but in fact, it's those who have followed this story and have followed this front for many years say it seems like we're reaching a tipping point where the U.S. does not come out and more assertively state its role vis-a-vis Taiwan. China will come in and just sort of create facts on the ground, and the U.S. ability to defend Taiwan will kind of lapse.
What about the counter-argument, Bob, that moving from strategic ambiguity to strategic clarity will be provocative to Beijing? I mean, my sense is that Beijing wants strategic clarity, but of a very different sort. They want to know that the United States is not going to come to the defense of Taiwan. So any sense of how Beijing is likely to react if the United States is clearer about its ties and support for Taiwan?
Well, it certainly seems like it would see it as a provocation, Jim, based on what you started off with, which was the comment from the Chinese foreign ministry, I think. But, you know, statements are one thing, but actions are another. And it's a question of whether or not China feels like it's ready to take this on. We should also note that just this past week, the U.S. Defense Department came out with a new estimate of Chinese capabilities, and particularly on the nuclear and naval front, it's ramped up. And so China is seen as more and more a sort of a strong competitor for the U.S., certainly in its own sphere of the world, all of which lends strength to that argument that you cited, Jim, which is that, you know, maybe we're provoking something that could lead in a direction that we're not going to be able to handle. So I think there's always that case. I think it's as with all diplomacy and with all sort of strategic calculations, you kind of decide when the moment is ripe for moving. And that's something that the U.S. is going to have to sort of consider. I think if you look back to the period of the Soviet era, you know, where the U.S. would challenge Russian assertiveness, you know, that the ultimate response and the concern was always that it could lead to something, some more serious escalation between two heavily armed nuclear powers. It didn't happen, although there were plenty of tense moments between the U.S. and the Soviets. In this case, it's an entity, Taiwan, that China considers part of its own, that one might imagine it taking, you know, aggressive steps to assert itself. But it's not clear whether China's ready to do that.
You know, Bob, just to link this back to our opening conversation about the election, it'll be interesting to see if this issue comes up at all over the course of the next 2 months. I don't say that because foreign policy decides elections. It very seldom does. But one of the benefits of having a campaign that discusses foreign policy is that you raise issues to educate the public. And obviously, if you're talking about the United States deepening its commitment to another country in the face of pressure from another superpower, in this case, China, that I think obviously raises issues that should be of great interest to the American public. And that is, do they support just that kind of policy? And, you know, it's one thing to read polls and try to guess at where people are, but obviously a campaign is an opportunity for a national conversation on issues like this.
Yeah, and I think it's also worth noting this comes within the context of an overall narrative, certainly the Trump administration would like to paint about the U.S. role in countering China, whether it's not allowing China to manipulate their response to the coronavirus, which has been stated as one of the concerns in joining a World Health Organization-led effort against the vaccine, or, you know, China's role as a economic rival, China's clamping down on human rights in Xinjiang, its moves against the democratic aspirations and the democracy in Hong Kong, and on and on. The administration is trying to say that it has stood up, and you heard this at the Republican convention, Jim, it has stood up against China in ways that previous administrations, Republican and Democratic, failed to do, whether it's the tariff actions or some of the other steps we've seen. And so that's definitely part of an overall narrative. Whether or not it sees Taiwan as something that could fit into a narrative pre-election is going to be very interesting to watch. Jim, let's stay in East Asia, specifically Japan, where earlier in the week, the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe unexpectedly stepped down from his post a year earlier than anticipated. Listeners to the podcast could get into a more in-depth discussion on this on the President's Inbox, our sister podcast that you host, Jim, following your discussion with Sheila Smith, our Japan expert. But Jim, could you set the scene for us in Japan? Why did Abe resign?
That's easy to answer, Bob. Health reasons. Prime Minister Abe has long been troubled by colitis. It caused him to resign from his first stint as Prime Minister back in 2007, after just a year in office. We have to assume that his colitis must have greatly worsened to get him to resign. Abe has been the longest-running Japanese Prime Minister. He's been in office nearly 8 years. It has long been rumored that he wanted to stay as Prime Minister through the Tokyo Olympics, which were supposed to be held this summer and are now set to be held next summer if conditions with the pandemic permit it. But he has opted to step down, and that's thrown open the question of who's going to succeed him. The way this works, because Japan is a parliamentary system, the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, which is the party that Abe leads, has to choose a new leader. That new leader then becomes the prime minister. There's a variety of ways the LDP can do that. My understanding is the route they're going to choose is to have the member of the LDP's party in the parliament, along with representatives from each of Japan's 47 prefectures, to cast a vote. And I think that process is supposed to start next week, and with an election likely held September 14th, so a little over 10 days from now. And as we look at it, to sort of understand where this is going to go, I think you have to understand that the LDP is not a uniform party. It is a party really made up of factions. And those factions are widely discussed in the Japanese press. And they're for the most part built around personalities. So as people rise up, they get followers in the party who are allied with them. And we're going to sort of see sort of where the factions see their interests lying. As we start the process, the betting money seems to be on the current chief cabinet secretary, Yoshihide Suga. He's often known as Abe's right-hand man. And he's in some ways an interesting choice to be prime minister because he doesn't appear to have a lot of support on his own, but it may be a case of which he is the person who is acceptable to the most number of factions. There are a couple of other candidates in the race, and we'll sort of see how all of this shakes out. It's happening at a very interesting thing, delicate time for Japan, particularly on the foreign policy front. What is interesting is that when Prime Minister Abe announced his resignation, he apologized to the Japanese people for not being able to complete his term. And he talked about his regrets of specific policies that he had hoped to make more progress on. One of them being getting Japanese being kidnapped by the North Koreans, brought back to Japan, failing to get a peace treaty with Russia. And I probably should do a little digression here. Russia and Japan have never signed a peace treaty closing out World War II. The sticking point has been islands north of Hokkaido that the Russians occupied at the end of World War II. And Abe, I think, hoped that he could get a couple of these islands, so-called northern islands to the Japanese, the Kuril Islands, to the Russians back under Japanese sovereignty. That didn't happen. So the next Japanese prime minister is going to come in with a bunch of initiatives that weren't finished. There's also going to be the question of where U.S.-Japanese relations go. Obviously, the other part of the question is what's going to happen with the U.S. presidential election and what president will a new Japanese prime minister be dealing with. I will note that Abe got a lot of credit in Japan for establishing a very good relationship with Donald Trump, a personal relationship that really sort of kept Japan out of the line of fire from a lot of President Trump's disruptive foreign policy tendencies.
I think he was the first foreign leader to meet Trump after his election.
Yes, he was. He was actually supposed to go to South America for a summit meeting. I forget which one. And when Trump got elected, they made a short detour. It was like 9,000 miles to go to New York, meet the president-elect. And he gave him a very expensive set of golf clubs, and they've famously played golf a number of times since then. But looking forward, the United States and Japan are about to enter potentially very tough negotiations over so-called host country support. That is the amount of money the Japanese government pays to subsidize the basing of roughly 50,000 American troops in Japan. You know,
That's been a bruising process in South Korea.
Very bruising, and all indications are the United States is going to make a significantly big ask of the Japanese. So that has the potential. There's also the issue of trade. Japan has a large trade deficit with the United States. It's well known that President Trump looks at deficits as basically a sign sign of whether you're winning or losing, or I should say losing the trade war. So things could heat up on that front. Of course, if Vice President Biden wins in November, that changes the context for it. And there's also an issue of Japan's relations with South Korea. You know, we think of Japan as an ally, South Korea as an ally for the United States. Most significant is that those two countries aren't allies with each other. They have some significant tensions in the relationship. They've really sort of bubbled up in recent years and become much more strained relationships. So the incoming prime minister will have to deal with that. So whoever gets picked, whether it's Mr. Suga or someone else, they're going to have a pretty full foreign policy inbox.
You know, Prime Minister Abe seemed to have almost unusually among leading democracies, you know, avoided the sort of buffeting of populist forces that we've seen throughout Europe and certainly in the U.S. and in the Western Hemisphere. Is that something that could be on the horizon in Japan, or is it just a different set of circumstances there? And as you said, Jim, maybe it's more personality-driven politics, but not necessarily populism.
There are no signs that Japan is seeing the populism that we've seen in the United States and in Europe. Indeed, a lot of people have written articles trying to explain why Japan is different in the rest. But having or not having a populist movement isn't the only thing that can royal politics in a country. And I think, you know, in Japan, besides the foreign policy issues, you know, that we've spoken about, there is the question of what is going to happen with Japan's economy going forward. Before Abe became prime minister, the Japanese economy was stagnant. And Abe introduced so-called Abenomics, which had some success, but not, I think, total success in revitalizing the Japanese economy. But if you're a Japanese prime minister and you're looking out at a world in which normal trade has been disrupted by the pandemic, and on top of that, there is growing trade nationalism, that's a real problem for you and for your companies. And then Japan has another problem, which is really beyond the ability of any prime minister to affect in the short run, and that is it is a very old society. Now, I talk sometimes about what the demography is of countries, the median age. You know, you look at a place like Afghanistan, where the median age is about 17 years, which means half of the population is above 17, half below 17, very young society. In the United States, and also in China, median age is about 38. Again, half above 38, half below. If you look at Japan, the median age is about 48 years old. And if you look at Japanese women, the median age is 50 years old. Now, of course, that plays back in the question of how do you make your economy function, because you need new people coming into the workforce to take over jobs and do jobs. But you also need younger people to be able to provide the safety net for older people. That sort of puts a lot of strains on government. And this is an issue the Japanese have been able to work through. They've been an older country for quite some time. But again, it's a big challenge to figure out what is it that can be done to sort of keep the economy going. And so again, next Japanese prime minister is going to have all of those problems, foreign policy and domestic, and is also going to be on a short clock before elections have to be called again. And that's where you might see whether the fractures in Japanese society, to the extent they exist, are politically relevant or going to change the course of the conversation. Bob, let's switch to our figures of the week. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a person, and I'm going to go back actually 5 years to a tragic person in the news. It's actually 5 years ago this week that the three-year-old body of a Syrian refugee, Elan Kurdi, washed ashore on the Turkish Mediterranean coast of Bodrum. It was a figure. There was a powerful photo that, you know, went worldwide. And I think, at least for a moment, galvanized international attention about the tragedy of the Syrian refugee waves that were leaving and that were families were taking treacherous Mediterranean voyages to try to get to Southern Europe and to find some sort of life. 5 years ago was also the period of time when you had Germany becoming a focal point for these, and the famous comment from Angela Merkel that we can handle this in terms of a wave of refugees was made. Things have changed quite a bit, obviously, since then. There ended up being a Turkish-EU deal that involved Turkey taking on the majority of refugees. And there's something like 3.5 million who are still in Turkey to this day. There are hundreds of thousands in other countries as well. And the Syrian civil war rages on. That the cause of this refugee wave, the almost 10-year-long Syrian Syrian civil war continues. So it would be good to say that the tragedy of Alan Kurdi created some sort of new international model for safeguarding refugee lives and families making treacherous trips and so forth. It hasn't exactly happened. It has certainly seemed to have eased the flow of people through those ways, although you're still seeing refugee crossings attempted by water and other means into Europe. But it's also time for stock taking. There's some looking back this week also at what Germany has done, among others. It was the country that took in the most refugees, something like 1 million when all was said and done. It has, in some cases, integrated them quite well. You had Syrians who were educated, who had some skills coming in, learning German, getting trained in German, and then joining the German labor force, a labor force that was actually in need of labor. There are still hundreds of thousands of Syrians who have not assimilated, they're in some sort of a limbo state right now in Germany, who can either become residents, but also are not being evicted at the moment. And in general, the rest of Europe has also been pretty much closed off to refugees. It's become an issue, and we were just speaking a bit about populism. It has become a major populist issue for especially Eastern European countries that are in the EU, Hungary, Poland in particular, to both ward off sort of directions from Brussels on how they should handle their sovereign affairs in terms of their borders and so forth, but also to sort of appeal to a state of nationhood and national identity in these places. And so it's a time for 5 years now. It's hard to believe it's been 5 years, but 5 years since the death of Alan Kurdi, it's a time for sort of taking note of what has happened in Europe, what has become of that first wave of refugees, and what is the future of the refugees in Turkey?
Bob, I think you put your finger on the really big question, which is what is going to happen with refugee flows in the future? And all signs point to more people wanting to move to escape problems at home and finding very little in the way of a receptive place to go. So this is going to be a big issue in global affairs, I think, for decades to come.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's not just conflict as the driver, which was obviously the case in Syria, but increasingly seeing aspects like climate or related aspect, which is food insecurity causing mass migration. And all signs there show it. Also, the pressure's only intensifying. Jim, who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, I'm going with a number as my figure of the week, and it is 98, as in 98%. The Congressional Budget Office announced yesterday that it projects that by the end of this calendar year, the amount of debt owed by the United States will total 98% of the nation's gross domestic product. That is, the amount of debt we have is going to basically be equal to our annual economic output. To give you some perspective, that's up from just 79% last year. And indeed, last year, looking out, people were talking about reaching that 98% number sometime much further in the 2020s. This is the highest number the United States has reached since the end of World War II. Why have the numbers jumped? Obviously, because deficit spending is way up, and it's way up because of the pandemic. We've had several stimulus plans designed to both ease the contraction of the overall economy and to try to stimulate it to come back. And this is an issue that's going to be sticking with us. You mentioned that Congress is coming back into session next week. The two sides have yet to agree on a new stimulus package, even though I think the leaders of both parties would like to go forward. Certainly the Democrats would. They're held apart by a very large gap. I think Republicans are willing to put about $1 trillion of stimulus spending on the table, and the Democrats at $4 trillion. One of the big sticking points is that a number of congressional Republicans, especially in the Senate, are really opposed to voting for any stimulus bill because they look at the red ink and say there's just way too much of it. I mean, you may recall, you know, going back 5, 6, 7 years ago, government red ink was the big issue domestically. It led to several government shutdowns. And so people look at it and say, if the problem was bad 5 years ago, it's much worse today. Now, you get a lot of people saying either A, it's not that big of a problem. And they'll cite things like modern monetary theory to say that for a lot of reasons, the problem of debt is overrated. You'll also get people who will say, you know, at this point with interest rates at rock bottom, now is the time to borrow. Now is the time to not just borrow, but to invest. So they would say deficit spending isn't bad if you budget, using that to basically build the building blocks for a much stronger economy down the road, one that will generate income and thereby taxes. And of course, you get the line of argument which says maybe accumulating this much debt isn't good, but what is our alternative when faced with what is a historic contraction in the economy? And we have to act. And if it creates problems down the road, we'll deal with them when we get down the road. So that's, I think, what's sort of percolating in the background as Congress comes back to Washington next week. And we'll sort of see how that unfolds as the two sides sort of both argue over the substance, but also, and this is Washington, try to use their substantive disagreements to help themselves politically and to put the other party in a corner.
Yeah, Jim, I think that last point in particular is going to sort of hold the day for at least a while in terms of the immediate concerns and the immediate need to lift the country out of its morass and really the federal government being seen as the savior. While at the same time, the immediate impact of a high debt bill is sort of less felt in a country like the United States than it would be in some other country where there's penalties that start to come to bear. The U.S. can finance it for now, and it has held this kind of unique position for a number of years, and that seems to be more of what will keep these numbers going higher and higher for a while.
Well, I expect that there will be at least some Democratic attack ads over the next 2 months that will remind people that President Trump, or I should say, candidate Trump, vowed to wipe away the national debt during his time in office. And not only has it not go down, it has gone up. But I think it's pretty easy to see the reasons why that has happened. And to what extent most voters go to the polls and choose a candidate based on debt as a share of GDP is unknown. I guess it's probably small. That doesn't mean we won't talk about it a lot.
Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. Greek Prime Minister Mitsotakis gives his annual speech on the state of Greece's economy. And North Korea marks Foundation Day.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. This week, Zoe Collins did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay safe out there.